You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Jonathan Latham. Jonathan, it's good to have you here this morning.
Good morning, Eric.
So, Jonathan, the way we start the show is, who are you, which is the huge question, but it's a chance to kind of sketch a picture that we can then start the conversation and fill out.
So, well, I am, by profession, I'm a biologist. I'm British. And I also have a family, some of whose members are in Ithaca.
Uh-huh.
And my wife is from Ithaca. And but I, you know, I don't, you know, I thought about this question more than any other question, actually, that you put out, sent to me, because the, you know, the, I don't really believe in the idea of being a person as a constant thing at all. You know, if I look back over my, you know, personal development, I've changed so enormously that you know, the question almost is meaningless. I mean, it's not a silly question, but it's not, you know, it's only meaningless
if you want to try to distill it to an essence.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
That's not what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah. So what are some of the qualities that you aspire to live?
Well, I think, you know, the basic one is a truthful life. Is mm-hmm. I think it's the bottom line of it. You know, if there are things about what I am, that would be a less facetious answer than I just gave you to your question would be, you know, I have certain aspirations that have been consistent over that time, and I identify it as coming from my well, the truthful life thing is that. You know, when I was very young, my mother, who's lovely in many, many ways, she used to lie to me. And it would be, the purpose of this lying was to try to make me do something. You know, can you dress up today because somebody's asked us to do something or other.
Right.
And it wasn't really true. She just wanted me to, and
she had to
give a reason.
Right.
And, you know, these are trivial things, really. But, you know, I was young enough, and she was bad enough at this lying business that it would enrage me. And so, you know, and I came to realize that it was a sort of a consistent pattern, and it really, you know, it became to really upset me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the whole idea of sharing untruths with other people, which, you know, many people argue, for example, you know, the whole basis of language mm-hmm. is deceit. You know, you want to try to, you know, almost all words are intended to manipulate other people. You know, I mean, it's not necessarily true between friends or whatever.
Tension between conceal and reveal.
Yeah, totally. And so you have this, you know, the reality of that, you uh-huh. know, has been a constant thing in my life. And so uh-huh. I entered science, you know, part of the reason was because I have this instinct or interest in understanding the truth. And mm-hmm. so if you do that, it seemed like a pretty good place to be would be a scientist, to try to get into some of these ideas.
Yeah.
And so it was pretty subconscious, you know, at the age of 17 or 18, you know, I don't think it was fully understood it, but it was something that came from inside. That was pretty clear.
Yeah. I mean, our decisions are only partly intellectually rationalized. They're emotional and they're physical in ways we don't even can't identify until after we've witnessed mm-hmm. them for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, That is a very beautiful explication of how you've become a scientist. You brought some music with you, and we're going to start with the John Prine song. Do you want to say anything about it before we go there? Or?
Well, this something, not really, but you know, I know many Ithacans are familiar with John Prine, so I thought we'd start with something that people might know.
Okay. It's "Please Don't Bury Me" by John Prine.
Woke up this morning, put on my slippers, I walked in the kitchen and died. And oh, what a feeling when my soul went through the ceiling and on up into heaven I did ride. When I got there, they did say, "John, it happened this way. You slipped upon the floor and hit your head." And all the angels say, just before you passed away, that these were the very last words that you said. Please don't bury me down in the cold, cold ground. No, I'd rather have them cut me up and pass me all around. Throw my brain in a hurricane, the blind can have my eyes, and the deaf can take hold of my ears if they don't mind the size. My stomach to Milwaukee if they run out of beer. Put my socks in a cedar box just to get them out of here. A Venus de Milo can have my arms. Look out, I got your nose. Sell my heart to the junk man and give my love to Rose. But please don't bury me down in the cold, cold ground. I'd rather have them cut me up and pass me all around. Throw my brain in a hurricane, the blind can have my eyes, and the deaf can take both of my ears if they don't mind the size. Oh man. I give my feet to the footloose, careless, fancy free, and give my knees to the needy. Don't pull that stuff on me. Hand me down my walking cane. It's a sin to tell a lie. Send my mouth way down south and kiss my ass goodbye. But please don't bury me down in the cold, cold ground. I'd rather have them cut me up and pass me all around. Throw my brain in a hurricane, the blind can have my eyes, and the deaf to take both of my ears if they don't mind the size. That's right.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Jonathan Latham. So, Jonathan, you know, what are the, you know, you talked about your tenacity for truthfulness, I guess that's how I'll put it. But what else helped to kind of, what experiences helped to shape you into the kind of science practice that you have?
Well, you know, specifically, I'm a biologist. And I started out as a plant biologist. And the essential reason for that was, you know, I like to spend time outside. And so from a very young age, I used to garden, you know, I started with radishes or whatever. And, you know, I get a plot in my parents' garden. I like flowers. I grow flowers. You know, so this is a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old right. or a 10-year-old. And so at school, we had a garden. I went away to school. And we had garden plots. And many of the children had garden plots. And so we used to grow all kinds of stuff. And so... You know, I always had a real interest in the whole process of growing things. And I, you know, I was not interested in cutting up animals, for example.
Right.
And so,
right.
you know, that basically led pretty naturally to into the idea of being a plant biologist.
Mm-hmm. What about, I mean, so the animals pushed probably killing or hurting animals probably pushed you away. But what drew you to plants? What about that process?
Well, you know, the other part of this is we grew up in a food culture. I mentioned my mother, right?
Yeah.
And she was a fantastic cook. But she, you know, she got her cooking not from England, but from France, you know, from reading Cordon Bleu magazine she had thousands of copies of. And she learned to cook from not being able to cook at all when she was married to being a fantastic cook. We would have home-cooked different meals. Every single evening there'll be something different. And so, you know, I became, you know, sort of fell in love with fantastic food. And so, you know, I expected that. And so if I didn't get it at school lunches or whatever, then gardening was a way of providing some of that.
Uh-huh.
You know, so there was all this kind of biology, in a sense, going on in the background as well.
Right. And biology in service to make the life you wanted to make yourself from a fairly early age.
Yeah, there seems such a powerful synergy between these things that, you know, it felt so much drawn to this. It seemed pretty unavoidable, really. It, you know, looking back on it, at least, I didn't know it at the time. But
yeah, Yeah, my first experience with a garden that I have any stories about was when I was 3 or 4 years old, and I'm one of seven children, and daycare was sometimes helping in the garden while I inadvertently pulled all the pepper plants and left all the weeds, which is a story that continues to travel on in my family for getting things wrong. But no, by the time I was 11, I was taking care of that garden, which was about an acre. Mm. We raised everything we ate.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean that's
it's a powerful way to live, to have those understandings. So where did that go? You know, from that early interest in plants and vegetables and.
Well, you know, I kind of continued. You know, I would say it continued as my work life mm-hmm. for a long time, and but you know, when I
but you
finally
had to, you had to get degrees in order.
Yeah,
to
yeah,
get
I got a, life, I so. Got an undergraduate degree in plant science mm-hmm. from a university in England, University of Bath, and then I did a master's. You know, one of the things though was I didn't get a good quality degree because I was always following my own path. You know, I'd spend time in the library, for example. But I would never be studying the course material. I'd be studying stuff that interested me.
Right.
So I tended to do badly on the coursework, but develop quite a good all-round understanding of stuff.
Uh-huh. So you were internally motivated more than even some students.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the workload was not massive.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and if you just wanted to coast by and get, you know, get the necessary degree with the smallest amount of work, then the course load was relatively light.
Right. 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 So what changed?
Well, I think, you know, I had a series of, you know, aspirations that consistently were disappointed, you know, intellectually by the university. And then when I entered into science, for example, you know, I could see that many people weren't motivated by the truth in the same way that I was. I could see, you know, many people were doing it for career or for prestige mm-hmm. Or for reasons, you know, sometimes just default, can't get a job, I'll do a PhD kind of thing. And
right.
so there were a lot of people in there for odd reasons. And, you know, which I, you know, certainly were different from mine. And so, you know, that meant that the pathway of science wasn't necessarily the way that I would have had it going.
Right.
And so when you have that experience and you see, you know, the leaders of your institutions or whatever are not taking their institution in the way that you'd like them to see, the people who fund your research are not taking it in the way they'd like you to see. So we, you know, we did a PhD, for example, in plant biology, and it was nominally all about agriculture, but we never went to a farm once right. in the whole course of that PhD, nor the master's either.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, you know, these people are you know, leaders of science are taking it in directions that has nothing to do with the stated reason for doing plant science research, right? It
right.
has to do with making money and corporate profits and steering agriculture in a certain path. And so you have these, you know, I had a sort of accumulation of these kind of dissonant experiences, if you like,
right.
in science.
Right. It's a whole institution of social organization and read control. That gets everybody on a similar page and people know how to interact.
Yeah.
But that's not
yeah.
what interests you.
No, it never was what interested me. And so, you know, and you start to realize that, you know, if you don't make a change in your life, then you will be dragged down into this too. So the question then becomes what to do about that.
So what was the change that you had to make in your life?
Well, you know, the first thing I did was switch career. So at that time, it was not normal to be a plant biologist, having done a PhD and then go study animals. But I started to make the jump into studying animals,
mm-hmm.
and I studied nematodes. And normally that was medical research.
Right.
But, you know, it soon became apparent to me that there wasn't too much genuine medical research going on either. It seemed like everybody was had their own agenda, if you like, for doing the science they were doing, but actually helping patients didn't seem to be very high on anybody's agenda. You know, the scientists were doing it because they, you know, they believed in things like pure research.
Right.
And the funders claimed that it was for medical research reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very skeptical of the value of that research.
Right.
And
right.
the other people that I saw around me.
And one of, we live in a culture where our justifications have to be really close at hand.
Yeah,
and many of the further downstream or further upstream justifications, people just don't think that holistically.
No, and you know, the you know, I've come to appreciate what Gore Vidal says, is that I never, you know, he had some quote about, I never believed the official justification for anything. and you know, that was so obvious in all of this research that we were doing, that there were hidden agendas, often multiple hidden agendas. You know, there are all these powerful forces causing research to go in one direction or another direction, or faster in this way or less in that. And there were all these powerful forces, none of which were represented in the official explanation of why we were doing what we were doing. And the patients were nowhere.
And where did you, and specifically, where did you see that, and what did you do?
Well, this medical research was in the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And so I moved that. You know, I did my PhD in England, then we moved to the University of Wisconsin. So you learn two things. You learn, firstly, that's the same everywhere, right? That it's not just specific to my institution or my country or whatever, that this kind of missing agenda stuff is going on everywhere. And so at that time we had a child. So this was 19 years ago. So he's now 19 years old. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's the opportunity to rethink stuff, right? And we started buying organic food and, you know, worrying about pesticides in the food. And we started, you know, realizing that, you know, if we were going to have a family life, for example, then we had to make a change from being academic scientists too. So one thing kind of, you know, there was some pushing as well as pulling going on in the decisions that we made. But we basically, my wife and I, we basically left academic science and went to work on an organic farm.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you do that?
Initially, we did that for a year. And then it became living on a farming community, which we did for 8 years, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. is also a fantastic place to bring up a child,
yes,
by the way.
Yes, yes, yes. So how has science come back into your life?
Well, what happened? No, it didn't really leave, you know, but it was, you know, we had kind of interesting experiences at the farm as well. You know, I was surrounded by alternative people, and we had this foot and mouth disease outbreak very few months after we arrived. And basically,
which is fairly rare in this country.
It's very rare in this country, and it's the second outbreak in about 50 years. And I had a friend, for example, whose parents lost their farm in the previous foot and mouth outbreak, sort of 40 years ago. I think it was the 1980s, 70s.
Wow.
In Britain. And so we had this situation where the government was telling people they had to do this and not do that, and they had the whole outbreak under control. You know, this is in the first few days or mm-hmm, week. Mm-hmm. And I told the people we were on, because we had a farm, we had sheep, we had cows, we had chickens, we had goats. I said, you know, I don't think you should believe what the government's telling you, that they have this disease under control. And we need to take responsibility for ourselves, sure, for our own farm. And because you have the situation when you're on a farm that not only can you be infected by someone else, but also your farm can be infected and you don't even know that.
Right.
And so you go on to another person's farm, or you go for a walk in the country, and all of a sudden you infected half your neighbors or whatever.
Right.
You don't want, you know, there's all kinds of, life becomes pretty interesting at that point. And so, but I had a, you know, I had a, my degree was in virology,
uh-huh, right?
My PhD was in virology. And so I'm telling these people what, you know, what I think they should do. Nobody gives a hoot what I think. You know, I just have a PhD in virology.
Right.
And this is a virus.
You couldn't possibly know anything useful.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was you know, that was a kind of a you know, something I didn't expect.
Uh-huh.
You know, that I'd gone to you know, so it challenged lots of my assumptions about, you know, how people, what people think about science, but also about people who, you know, call themselves alternative, whatever, you know, whether they really behave any differently from the people who are in power and so forth that I'd objected to when I was doing a scientific degree.
Arrogance is arrogance wherever you find it.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, they, you know, they wanted to make the argument that I was being arrogant, you know, right, and that was, yeah, no, you know, and they can, you know, I can understand where they're coming from,
right,
but they also didn't want to listen to the evidence that I was presenting, right, for example.
And the failure to listen is the genuine problem.
It's very often it is, yeah. And there's some reason why people don't want to do that.
Yeah. So what happened with the hoof and mouth outbreak?
Yeah. So, well, what we ended up happening was we didn't in the end lose our animals. But at one point we were convinced we would. The animal, the farm, the government was basically, if the disease was found on your farm or you had an adjoining farm, they were basically pile up your animals in a field and set fire to them, right?
Yeah.
And so And we had, there were funeral pyres in three different directions from our house at one point.
Wow.
And so at that point, we thought, you know, we got to be within 3 miles of these things because we can see them. And so, but they never did come to our farm.
Wow.
And it was, you know, there was a lawsuit. One of the also interesting things was there was a lawsuit going on, which I subsequently came to know the people. And they basically forced the government to accept that they were not doing this burning business based on any legitimate science that they had, that it was purely economic decisions that were going into this. They were trying to protect the big farmers. And these people told me afterwards, they actually won their lawsuit, but they got a phone call from the government, the prime minister's office, basically asking, you know, begging them to throw the lawsuit on the last day when the judge was supposed to decide, which they did. You know, which is, to me is incomprehensible. Like
they threw it so they could get a financial settlement.
No, they got nothing out of it. They'd put millions of pounds into it. Oh, you know, wow. They got a wealthy benefactor to support them.
I see.
They basically threw. They had a consultation. You know, we've been told by the powers that be that we should throw the lawsuit, and they did it. Wow. And to me, that's that. You know, there was a total failure of integrity on their part,
right.
because you know they had the law on their side, they had right on their side, and you know you don't enter a lawsuit on the basis that we're going to throw it when it really becomes an important issue. Right?
Did it change? Did the only time to throw it is if the changes in practice?
Yeah, but there, no such thing was happening.
And that never happened.
No.
What? Yeah. Let's cut to music. Shall we play the Celia Cruz piece, or do you want to go through?
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah.
Okay. And do you want to say anything about it?
Well, I love a lot of Cuban and South American music because it's so lively and expressive, and okay. I want to.
Here we go. Yes, listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and that was Celia Cruz and Yerbero Moderno. And our guest on this hour is Jonathan Latham. So, Jonathan, when you talk about your commitment to truth and truth in science as an avenue to pursue that commitment, what do you mean? What does that look like on a daily basis for the average citizen?
Well, you know, I mean, science has become more and more important in people's lives, right? So, you know, if you go back to 1945, mm-hmm. you know, people weren't listening to the results of scientific papers. Nobody talked about it in the media. There were relatively limited areas in which people would listen to science as a way of understanding the world. Because, you know, in many ways, science wasn't powerful enough to explain a lot of things.
Right. Well, I,
you know, there was some basics, you know, but going back to the Enlightenment, mm-hmm. you know, the very earliest scientists imagined they had, you know, they were describing a clockwork universe,
right.
you know, with Newtonian laws and such like, and everything conformed to those laws. But, you know, none of the details could be filled in. Like, nobody understood really anything about biology, you know, in a scientific mm-hmm. sense. Whereas, you know, the situation has changed such that nowadays, the whole of, you know, every question that you can ask in a public domain has some kind of scientific answer to it. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who want, who have a strong interest in what that answer is, mm-hmm. right? And so, in a sense, what we've seen is whether or not science has a good answer for these things. There are people, you know, often scientists, but often sometimes not scientists, who will proclaim that there is a scientific answer to this right. question, right? And that scientific answer can be used to manipulate people, right? If you can give an authoritative sounding answer to that question, right. then basically people will are highly likely to pay a lot of attention to it. You know, science has replaced the church as the sort of legitimating function in our society. You know, if there is a scientific opinion about something, that becomes the sort of norm. And if you don't, if you want to deviate from that norm, you know, people will understand that maybe you have an ethical or an mm-hmm. economic or whatever mm-hmm. reason to deviate from that norm. But you have to have a reason, right?
Right.
You know, in policy circles, for example. And so we've built up this whole understanding that, you know, if some answer doesn't come from that science should be able to provide answers to things, mm-hmm. and that you know, if there is a scientific answer, then you should know what it is, or you should basically stand away from that subject. You know, your opinion is no longer valid, right? And what this has done is create a huge power opportunity for the authorities, basically to manipulate science and to supply answers mm-hmm. that are amenable to their, you know, whatever project that they have going.
Right. So how do you use science to counter the institutional manipulation of science?
Well, so basically the way it worked for us was originally when we moved to this organic farming community, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. we genetic engineering came along, and I'd been a genetic engineer as part of my PhD, but I didn't want to use it for agriculture, but there were people who did, and so. Companies were bringing genetically engineered crops to Britain, and they were peddling a myth about, you know, what turned out to be a myth about the precision of genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. And the whole myth of precision was based on the idea that, you know, if we say that we're engineering this trait into this crop, then that's what will happen. Right, and so there's no need for risk assessment, for example, because we put virus resistance, or we put insect resistance, or we put herbicide resistance into this genetically engineered crop. And because we have this myth of precision, therefore we know that no risk assessment is necessary because it's going to do what we say it's going to do. And so we ended up writing our first post-academic scientific mm-hmm. paper, which is a review paper of how accurate this myth of precision was in genetic terms. Like, what kind of a mess did putting a new gene make of a plant genome or of an animal genome? Mm-hmm. And what, you know, for example, what DNA was lost, what extra DNA was added by mistake, what kind of messes of mixed up pieces of DNA wound up in mm-hmm. that insertion event. And it turned out that the myth of precision was exactly that. It was basically backwards to the truth.
Right, so there's a lot more imprecision. What's the consequences of the imprecision?
Well, they can be. There are many of them. I mean, the Roundup Ready soybeans that until a few years ago were grown on 95% of U.S. acres soybean acreage. They have a 10% yield drag. Right? So those beans are yielding 10% less than their exactly identical non-GMO versions.
Right.
And nobody ever found out the reason for that. I mean, Monsanto keeps what information it has close to their chest. But, you know, it steadily came out that there was a huge difference between the yields of these crops. And so they were pushing a story, not only of precision, but also of the high yields of their crops. And both of them were inaccurate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And things like that. I grew up in a soybean-producing part of the U.S. in northwest Missouri. And there's a local provider of seed that has, I guess, exploited that kind of advantage now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What I see you do, you are becoming a watchdog on the reports of science, of institutional or corporate science.
Yeah.
How do you make that work?
Well, you know, I mean, there is an audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially, you know, the food movement is becoming more and more strong, powerful, influential, and paid attention to. And so, you know, if we can publish things that, you know, 10 years ago would have been obscure and nobody would be reading, you know, unless it wasn't picked up by some, you know, big NGO or something like that. Whereas nowadays, even if an NGO, if no NGOs pick up the research that we put out, there's a huge audience sometimes for for the output that we have. So we can, you know, publish an analysis or do some investigative work around some issue. And you know, all of a sudden you can find that 100,000 people come and visit your website. And that's something that, you know, never could have happened when we started. You know, we did finally, we got 10,000 copies downloaded. That paper that I just described to you, the review paper, we printed 10,000 copies and we took them to conferences, but also 10,000 people downloaded them from our website in 2006, 2007. So, you know, it steadily improved, you know, the means of communication of this kind of information.
One of the things that makes certain kinds of institutional approaches difficult to challenge is people don't know how to evaluate what they've done. With your work, how do people assess your work?
It's a challenge, right? I mean, the whole attraction of science as a propaganda machine to the establishment or the powers that be is that non-scientists can't evaluate that research very easily. You know, you have to go look at the original research, and there are, you know, there's no fundamental litmus test for scientific integrity.
Right.
You know,
right.
you just have to know enough or trust the person. You have to know enough about the science or trust the people that you're reading enough to share that information. You know, one of our big things is don't share information if you don't know that it's true. Right, and that means, you know, not only from us, but also from companies or from governments and so forth. So you know, we sort of have informal policies that we won't share any information that we're not certain of it being accurate.
Uh-huh. And how do you check its accuracy?
Well, the bottom line is, if you can't, then you have to treat it as not accurate.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
And so you know, but there are many, many ways. I mean, sometimes. There's no rule. I don't think there is a rule of thumb.
Right.
You know, I mean, when I worked at the University of Wisconsin, I was working in a genetics department, and I got to understand a lot about genetics and you know, which is, you know, complicated math, and it's difficult stuff to do sometimes because there's multiple genes, you know, interacting with each other, and there are all these variants that we don't really understand, and such like, you know, it's not the simple story that often you're led to believe, but you do have to understand something about that not so simple story. But you know, in the course of my career, I've been a virologist, an RNA biologist, a DNA biologist, i.e., a geneticist. I've been a physiologist. You know, I've had all these different exposures to different areas of science that enable me to have the sort of background necessary to check up on people's stories.
one of the I want to try to make a connection, and I'm not sure it's going to actually work. Within the realm of science, you're really looking for what you can fairly objectively test and replicate, and that's a certain kind of intellectual knowledge. And as human beings, we tend to process information and knowledge in a more complex way, which is intellectual, emotional, and physical. And we have to deal with our tendencies to distort, either overvalue our point of view or overvalue other people's points of view, or overvalue the institutions that help define what's reality for us. I've just outlined the three major issues of religion, where you said, you know, the science has taken over the role. Institutional science has taken over the role of institutional religion.
Yes,
the
precisely.
Important yeah. word there is institutional. The object of science is usually more an objective understanding, but the object of religion is putting oneself and one's past in perspective. Mm-hmm. So that you can address mm-hmm. a future, and that means mm-hmm. it's a different kind of knowledge, and people who are devout practitioners of any spiritual or religious tradition question themselves as much as they question objective data,
yeah,
because they know that without that kind of humility, the opportunity for error is huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we tend to see the two, science and religion, is at odds with each other, but from this point of view, they're necessary
yep.
for each other at the same time.
Yep.
And I mean, I see you practicing some of that or trying to be that self-critical in terms of the science industry. How do you bring that practice into your own life?
I mean, there are many heuristics, if you like,
yes.
that you can use, right?
Yes.
You know, one of them is, you know, if something...
And a heuristic is a...
It's a sort of rule of thumb.
Right.
Right? It's a way of making things easy for you. And you know, one is that you question things if they come from official sources.
Yeah.
You question things if they come from companies.
Uh-huh.
You question things if you like the sound of them. You know, they feel like they fit into your worldview. You should question them more.
Right, right.
Right? Right. But... You know, the basic, you know, going back to my education, what happened for me was that I had terrible eyesight when I was young. And I used to, so I couldn't read the blackboard. And I didn't want to sit at the front of the class.
Right.
So I just would listen to the teacher and what they were saying. And I wouldn't be busy writing everything down for the purpose of passing the exams. And so I would think about all the things that the teacher said.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of developed this habit of passing every piece of information that I was given. And, you know, kind of assigning it a confidence value or something
right.
like that, right? You know, is this, am I confident this is true, or do I think this is total rubbish, or somewhere in between, there's some place, I'm put it in some holding place where, like,
right.
you know, this is an interesting opinion, but I don't necessarily want to accept it right
but
now.
Once you have spent that much time with it, it actually enters into your memory.
Yeah, it can. You know, you can, for example, you know, there is a danger that you take these thoughts and you integrate them into your thought processes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what I sort of became reasonably good at was you know, not letting thoughts become integrated into my worldview, which I wasn't really convinced that were accurate and truthful things, right?
Yeah.
And so you have, you know, so I've sort of ended up with a mindset that, you know, when I talk to people, it's quite, I'm coming from quite unfamiliar place in many instances, because, you know, I haven't really incorporated many of the ideas that many people have. And so I tend to question different things and accept different things than many other people would do.
Mm-hmm. And that's at the first pass.
Yeah.
But at the second pass, how have you had to, over the course of your professional life, had to change a deeply... Have you ever had to change a deeply held commitment? Because it just didn't... It didn't work. It wasn't helpful. It wasn't valid or truthful.
Well, you know, I mean, there's always been... You know, I mean, when we were... I think ultimately, you know, I have dipped in and out of different, for example, different methodologies of mm-hmm. science. You know, when I started off as an ecologist, right? That's what I really wanted to do. And my professor said, you know, so when I was an undergraduate, he said, you'll never get a job as an ecologist. Right. He said, become a molecular biologist. That's where all the money is. You should go and do that. And so I
did
my...
You don't do the big picture. You do the very narrow.
Yeah, you do this tiny little thing, which is, to me, was intensely dissatisfying. But I was happy. You know, I was sort of happy to do it at the level... You know, the answers you get when you do that kind of reductionistic science mm-hmm. are true, right? You know, as far as we know. You know, this is one of the other things about science. Yeah, you can test them. But, it is the fundamental basis of science that you never for all time accept that something is true. You know, people have science is overthrowing all its ideas on a routine basis. One of my favorite quotes is Richard Feynman, science is a belief in the ignorance of experts. Right, and the idea is that if you don't go into science because everybody is right and they've all figured out all the answers and there's nothing for you to do, you wouldn't go into science on that basis, right? You go in because you think that you can be the new Newton or the new Einstein or whatever it is and overthrow everything that came before it. And so, but that's not how science is taught in schools. So you do have to come to understand it. If you really want to be a scientist, you have to basically understand that there is a possibility and you want it to actually happen, right? In order to create some kind of development and new understanding, basically that you're going to have to take the work of your professor and throw it into the rubbish bin and say, look, sorry prof, but this is all rubbish. And so you have to have some understanding that that's what you're going to do, and that a lot of people are not going to like you for that, right? This is going to be a controversial thing that when it happens.
Right, and I guess what I hear you in the rhetoric of this is going to be rubbish is that there may be some elements of truth in it, but it's going to change, and people are often wedded to things that they've questions that they've answered, and the point is that for every answered question, there's a trail of many more unanswered ones that we haven't really come to fully understand yet.
Yeah, I mean, the data, you know, often the data points are not different, right? But it's the paradigm shift, it's the understanding of them.
Right, or if the data points are the artifacts of measurement systems which mm-hmm. are no longer helpful,
yeah.
and we need different measures.
It can be.
Let's cut to a piece of music. What should we go to next?
Manu Dibango is good.
Okay.
It's also super fun.
And is this for diversity purposes or just
it's sort of not too far off representing my record collection.
That's okay. So, and that's what I was asking about. In your record collection, where does this what portion of your record collection does this represent?
He's African.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But jazz.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Jonathan Latham. So, Jonathan, in the last, you know, large segment chunk of the show, where I like to turn is, well, what do you do personally to take care of yourself? You know, when you get off-centered, or this is basically an effort to span across secular and religious and cultural approaches to self-care, emotionally, intellectually, physically. What do you do daily, weekly, whenever, and how do you know you need to take a break or do something?
Well, there's a whole bunch of things that I do. You know, I've co-founded a nonprofit with my partner, and basically sort of our time is our own. We can spend it as we want.
Sure.
So I've just come from a yoga class, for example. Uh-huh. So twice a week I go to Sunrise Yoga Center, which is I can recommend thoroughly. And but I also, you know, the sort of most, you know, apart from obvious physical things, like, you know, I need to go for walks and such, like, the contact with the natural world is the, you know, without that I would have gone mad. Do you know what I mean? Because if you end up questioning a lot of things, it can be a very ungrounding process.
Well, you're constantly the provocateur. You're constantly attacking or challenging or
but you're doing it inside your own head too, right? What people see is the public version, but inside your head you're doing that too.
Right.
And so you need some kind of way of bringing yourself back to reality, right? And for me, reality is the forest or the fields or the rivers or the, you know, the things that precede, you know, were here before humans ever were, for example.
Right.
And so you know, I go and you know, try to understand those, you know, go for a walk, right? And you you look at the trees and you learn what the species of the trees are, and you learn what the species of the plants are, and you learn about the bugs that visit them, and you learn all this stuff about the natural world. So it's not merely just lying down in a field or something as a non-intellectual process, but it's trying to understand the ecosystems and the interactions that are going on in those systems, and I think there's a whole bunch of things that you get from that process. You know, one is it's very calming, but the second thing is that you know, the natural world truths, if you like, what people say in a very compelling way. You know, if you know about the species that live in woods, and you know about the animals that visit them and so forth, it so often contradicts what you're told, you know, on the radio or on the TV or reading the newspapers about what's going on in the natural world. And so you have an opportunity to develop your own understanding, right? So you know, the basis of science and religion is to develop an understanding of the natural world. And you can do that in the absence of either science or religion, right? I can go for a walk and I can see this certain plant being visited by this certain thing or whatever. Or see if they're, you know, see which trees are doing badly in the drought, you know, for example. You can develop your own understanding of how bad the drought is, for example. You know, we hear on the radio, oh, the drought's terrible, or whatever it is. But you can truth that, right? You can go into the fields and the forests or whatever, and you can see whether that's really true or not. And so that process of wandering around in nature is, you know, in a sense, has many times kept me sane, if you like.
Right.
And so it's an intellectual form of self-care.
Right, and I guess what I'm struck by, because you're the first person who's described this practice in quite this way. So by going out into nature, both with some knowledge and equipped to observe, to test, and find further knowledge, ask questions, and go back and stuff, you have this back and forth relationship with the natural world, which then helps to keep your mind from spinning out of control. And I've never heard it described in quite that way, quite that simply.
Yeah.
What about the life of the mind is so destabilizing?
I mean, I think it wouldn't. It's not inherently destabilizing, but we live in a society in which a lot of people are lying to us, right? You know, the government is lying, and you know, every advertisement is a lie, basically.
Right.
You know, they're all trying to sell you something that you don't need for reasons that are not true. Right. And so we're just absolutely bombarded with misinformation all the time. So, you know, we don't own a TV, for example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're not subjected to most of that stuff. But it still comes across to us. You know, I read the newspapers. Sure. You know, you read a newspaper article and it's purportedly about something. Mm-hmm. But they'll give you an introductory statement, for example. And that introductory statement is just supposed to get you onto the page of the right. where the story is going to go. But often that actual statement is also a lie. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not the premise of the whole article is untrue. Right? And so we live in this very, very disorienting world. Mm-hmm. And so some instability, you know, some source of stability is absolutely necessary to right. me, and I think to other people too.
Right. Yeah. And so and yoga is something. It's a practice that you do, but you also do it in a group.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine the positions and the transitions are talked through yeah. so that you respond to the environment in a way as you write your own ship.
Yeah.
And the similar sort of thing happens in nature. What other things do you do?
Yeah. So it is, you know, like you say, I just want to bring out this. Sure. The one thing about yoga is that, you know, you're attempting to develop a truthful relationship with your own body.
Right.
Right. Right. So you're trying to understand your body. You know, where does the pain come from? Where does the discomfort come from? What is helping? What is not helping? So it's mm-hmm. basically, you know, we live in this disembodied world of the Enlightenment in which we're not connected to our body. And yoga is about bringing you back to that connection, mm-hmm. right? Which also is a truthful thing. Right. And so they have sort of analogous roles in my life, if mm-hmm. you like, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. two things, yoga and going out into the natural world.
What do you do for emotional care or balance?
Well, you know, friends are the big thing, right? And family. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's not too many other sources of those things that are, you know, feel to me authentic. You know, music is also a big one, right?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, and, you know, but I don't want to talk about music without talking about friends and family.
Sure.
So, you know, listening to music, I've always spent a lot of time listening to music. I want to hear people's authentic expressions of themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and always, you know, I want to hear. I mean, what I like about John Prine, for example, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. is the fact that he's kind of an unusual singer in that he doesn't really put too much emotion into his singing. You know, it's the opposite of Dolly Parton. Right? Yeah, yeah. You know, Dolly Parton will ham it up.
Yeah.
Right, in this most tremendous way or whatever, you know, because she thinks, you know, she's singing about a line in which she thinks, you know, the audience should be crying and so you should be crying and whatever. But to me, it's the inauthenticity of it comes in because, you know, she basically it's saying to you, you should be crying at this point because I don't want to be laughing when Dolly Parton is crying, right? I want to be, you know, the presumption is I'm going to be crying along with her. But of course, when Dolly Parton, you know, not of course, for fans of Dolly Parton, but of course, to me, I'm thinking this is ridiculous, and so it's inauthentic. Whereas when John Prine sings, he lets you have your own emotion, right? Because he's not putting something into it that isn't already there. You have to listen to the words and listen to the music and draw your own conclusions.
Right, and that's because there's a difference between Clifford Geertz wrote a beautiful essay in which he used the idea of when is a wink, when is it an involuntary reflex, when is it telling you that you're in on something, and people who sing with that kind of are inviting you into play, like you're playing with them. Whereas John Prine was, I guess, a letter carrier, works for the post office, and got into singing and delivers it in a kind of a Midwestern matter of fact style without playing with you. It plays you, but it doesn't play with you.
Yeah.
And they're authentic, but they're authentic in different ways. And how do you play? How do you play?
Well, what I do is write.
Yeah.
Okay.
And maybe.
And
play,
so I'm writing. I'm writing articles. I don't play a musical instrument, but I do write. You know, we try to remove all the superfluous words. Mm-hmm. We try to arrange the ideas in the simplest possible form. And we try to take out all the judgment words, right? Yeah. Because if you're trying to say something that's important and interesting, it has to be laid out in such a way that people can critique it. You know, if I read other people's writing, well, a lot of my issue is that they've jumbled up the idea so much that actually, you know, the amount of effort and time it would take to critique what's actually being said there is inordinate.
Right, and many criticisms are written to evoke emotional responses or physical responses that do not have, it's a different kind of communication. And you're talking about an intellectual communication that has a certain kind of rigor to it. And that's where your work lives.
Yeah, you're trying to distill these ideas into the most simplest form in a way that people can understand. You know, there's very complicated ideas in all this, but there are also some super simple ones.
Sure.
You know, and so...
And the discipline hones them down to that.
Yeah, I mean, people's attention span, you know, you're attentive to, but also... you know, people don't always have the you know, nobody's had the experience that I have, or, you know, we all, none of us have had each other's experiences. Right. So we have to bring each other into that world.
Right.
And, but try to explain, you know, to what extent people have been misled about things. For example, you know, I'm writing an article at the moment about what is called DNA is not the molecule of life. Right. Now, it turns out that DNA, we talk about DNA all the time, right, in media, and it's absolutely crazy. But, you know, there's a molecule that existed long before DNA existed called RNA. DNA is basically a form of RNA that it can easily be stored, right, and passed on through generations. But RNA existed before there were cells, before there were proteins, before there was DNA, before, you know, basically it's... And even nowadays, huge parts of your cells are built around RNA molecules. But we never study, we don't hardly study them because they're very unstable, they're chemically reactive, they just fall apart. Yeah, which also makes them super useful, right? And so it's like the kitchen of biology is all this RNA stuff that's going on. And the larder is your DNA, right? And we're studying the larder. Right, and actually, the real business is going on inside the kitchen with all this RNA. You know, it's moving between cells. It's turning on genes. It's turning off genes. It's totally, you know, in many some ways, running the show.
And you're inviting.
And yet we never talk about it.
But you're inviting us to be aware of that messiness, so that we can understand bits of it where it matters to our lives.
But where it matters in our lives is that DNA has become an ideology.
Right. No, that's what I mean. Yes. Right? Yes.
Yeah. And
that's
what so you know, being misled into this whole story of DNA and the heritable material and all this kind of stuff, and it's so important for evolution that we understand all this stuff. But it's a story that basically feeds into the politics of our day. And that's why the DNA story has been sort of so built up by the scientific community.
Absolutely. Jonathan, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you, Eric.
And we're going to close with Clint Eastwood and General Saint, Stop That Train. Do you want to say anything or no?
Oh, no. It's just a super fun.
Well, let's go out on some fun.
The next train will be leaving from platform 1.